and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tinellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. In 2020, Allen and Unwin, one of Australia's big five publishers, announced the opening of submissions for its inaugural Crime Fiction Prize, a competition that was open to both published and unpublished Australian or New Zealand writers of crime fiction. And from 340 manuscripts submitted, one winner emerged. Vicky Petratis is the author of a number of crime books, including the best-selling book, The Frankston Murders, about serial killer Paul Digne and the Phillip Island murder. More recently, Vicky has made two highly successful podcast series with Case File Presents, series which have top charts around the world and enjoyed millions of downloads. It's this true crime writing and investigative experience that Vicky brought to her first work of fiction, The Unbelieved. Now that I've devoured it from cover to cover, I can certainly understand why it won this accolade. Empowering, explosive, gritty, and insightful, The Unbelieved is a story everyone should have on their must-read list. And I'm more than delighted, thrilled actually, to have the opportunity to speak about it with Vicky on the podcast today. Welcome, Vicky.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Claudine.
It's my pleasure. And as I said before we started recording, I wanted to say congratulations on this novel. How are you feeling about its publication?
Look, it came out in a rush. It's very different. Like, this is number 18, you know, in terms of books for me. It's very, very different when you write fiction. When you write true crime, the focus is very rarely on the writer. You just put out the book. The focus is always on the crime. And so for me, it was kind of stepping out of my regular zone where I put a book out and everybody talks about a crime and the crime gets recognition, and all of a sudden the spotlight turns on the author. So I found that really interesting. And I also found it interesting that I kind of got included in a lot of writers' festivals since the book came out in August, which really doesn't happen. So normally it's just me and my computer or me and my microphone, and this one has been a bit more spotlighty.
Yeah. Did it change the way you feel about your writing or your writing process?
No, I think I've been really interested in the reviewing process. I know that they say don't read the reviews, but the reviews for The Unbelieved have been, by and large, really awesome. And people have just, they, like you said, you know, that this is a must read and it's unputdownable. And so the reviewers are saying lovely things. But what I'm fascinated with, because it's a theory of mine about books, is that when you get a one star review, that no writer can please everyone. And I know this from being in a book club for over 25 years. When you do a book and people will say, you know, loved it, you go around the circle and someone goes, nah, hated it, couldn't finish it. The next person says, oh, I want to read everything that author's ever written. And so I know from book club that no book, you know, the book is the book doesn't change. I think it's what you bring to the book. And so I think as a writer, I love that it has resonated with a lot of people. Yeah. I also acknowledge that it won't resonate with other people, and that's okay. I just wish reviewers would be a little bit more, you know, saying this book didn't suit me, rather than there's something wrong with this book. You know, I wish that people would take, as a reader, you know, you take more of a personal responsibility and say this book was not for me. I acknowledge it's for other people, but it's not for me, and I'm going to move on. I don't need to get kind of catty about it, which some people do.
Look, I've talked about that on this podcast before, the, you know, seemingly intense need for reviewers to not just bag the book, so to speak, but to bag the writer in the process. And also by bagging the writer, try and sway other people from reading the book, which I find a very interesting psychological phenomenon.
As a crime writer, I find that kind of thinking really interesting too, because I see that in some of the characters that I've written about in real life. It's that sort of sense of entitlement and sense of, well, I'm right, this is my opinion, therefore if anyone doesn't think what I think, that they must be wrong. And that's a very, I mean, I'm a teacher as well, and that's something that kids do. And so be gentle with your reviewers. And when you write a review, authors will read them. So write the review and think, if she was reading it, what would I, what message do I, you know? And I just think if you were in, I don't know what it is about writers. But, you know, sometimes people think that writers can be like punching bags. And as a true crime writer, I've always had this. So people would say, if they say, what do you write, true crime? Oh, I'd never read that. Yeah, whatever. You know, what do you want me to say to that? I don't know. Mm. So I found that process really interesting. And I think when you have, you know, that thing, negativity bias, that, you know, our brains are wired so that when we hear something negative, that takes precedence over 100 positives. And I kind of researched this a couple of years ago when my podcast came out. And someone had said, oh, you know, I don't like her voice. She sounds like you're being lectured to by a teacher. And I went, ouch. One of the teachers at my school, she said, oh, I love your podcast. And I said, oh, someone said I sound like a, you know, primary teacher lecturing. She goes, oh, that's negativity bias. And she, and I had never heard of it. And I looked it up. And I think once we know it exists, we can push back against it, so that our brains are designed that if you hear the snap of a twig when you're a cave person, that will make you run, and that noise will stand out because it could be a saber-toothed tiger or whatever's going to eat you. And so your brain is designed to take that under consideration more than the sunshine and the trickle of the waterfall. And so I try and push back against that and just say, okay, your natural reaction is, ow. But then, you know, you push back against it and saying that's just your brain giving that more attention than it deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I hope the many writers who listen to this podcast are actually taking this in and not letting those one-star reviews affect them and their perception of their ability to be a writer. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and luckily the Unbelieved, I mean, I think the average rating is 4.5 stars out of 5. So, and this is the thing that we talk about the one star, but there's so many absolutely beautiful reviews that have just blown me away. And you know, you just read them and you go, oh, my God, they get me.
Yeah. I understand, Vicky, that you wrote this book as part of your PhD in creative writing.
Yes. Just because life wasn't hard enough already, I decided to do a PhD in creative writing purely because a lot of other writers that I know were doing, you know, they were all doing it. Mm. And I told the story about sort of I was at a lunch table with about 9 people, and of all of the 9, 2 of us didn't have PhDs, and one of the 9, you know, one of the 2 was a kid who was in grade 5, so she had an excuse, and the other one was me. And it's kind of like, oh, and they're all saying, go to La Trobe. La Trobe's amazing. They will love what you do. And so it's like, all right, you know, just in one of those things. I think writers are always looking for ways to push their talent and push their skill set, aren't we? You know, that you don't just write a book and go, well, that's it. You know, I don't ever have to do that again. Mm. I think for me, ever since I was in my early 20s, the minute a book was finished, I was almost like, you know, that chipmunk at the beginning of, is it that cartoon that the little chipmunk is kind of, you know, chasing the nut? Ice Age, that's right.
Ice Age, yes.
And it might not even be a chipmunk, but you know what I mean. And kind of that, you know, like that nervous twitch of got to be writing. And I think that I've always had that. And the minute a book is finished, the minute it's handed over to a publisher, I'm like, what's next? I cannot not have a book to be working on. And so I think for me it's always been next, and what can I do? What story can I tell? How can I push at the boundaries of what I'm doing? And every time I get to the next level, it's like, what's next?
Yeah.
So the PhD was a natural progression for that. And one of the lecturers, Dr. Kelly Gardner, who's just amazing, and she said to me, take it slowly. Just enjoy this journey. Don't treat it like, you know, writers are like book a year. Just take it slowly and enjoy the ride, enjoy the learning. And I really took that on board. And so I finessed that book for 4 years. And then when Ellen and Unwin announced their crime prize, I went, that's it, I'm going to win that. And I'm going to use the deadline for the crime prize as the deadline for me to finish this. And it was, it was probably about maybe 60 or 70,000 words into the 80 that it had to be. So it was just this finessing process that by the time I handed it in, I would be really surprised if there were more than one or two typos. It was as perfect as I could get it. And I thought, I really felt confident that I would win it because it was something that I had put my heart and soul into. Mm. And the fact, you know, when I got that phone call and when Jane Helferman, you know, rang me and said, "You've won the prize." And I went, "I knew it. I knew it." I know a lot of people, they're humble. I'm not, not where that was concerned. You know, like this, I was on this panel at Sydney with, it was like winners of crime awards, and there was a lot of, "Oh, I didn't expect it." And me, like, I knew it. Is that wrong? Do I sound mean?
As I said, having read your book now, I can totally understand why it did win. And more power to you for having that self-belief.
I've never suffered from that. Like a lot of people have imposter syndrome, and I've just always been too busy and too fixated on what's next to ever be worried about what will people think. What, you know, just, I don't know, it's like being on a steam train that you're just chugging forward all the time and never looking back to wonder if you're good enough. Or I'm very lucky to have never suffered from that ever.
I love that. So is the published version different from what you produced initially? So what you submitted to the Crime Prize, is it different from what was published?
Yeah, so my PhD had to be 80,000 words. And so pretty much, knowing me, I'm a bit of a, I'm a bit like that. It would have been like 80,000 on the knocker just for fun when I submitted it. And the end product, I think, was about 88,000. Okay. Yeah. So what they did was they said, "No, we don't really, we want to flesh out more of that character," or "we want to," they didn't change it a lot, which I was really happy with, but they just picked out a couple of things that I hadn't sort of thought of. And so we had fun just rounding out. There's a point where there's a character and she doesn't know that she's got a grandmother. And it was like, "Well, let's have her meet the grandmother." And I'm like, "Oh, of course. Yeah, I can do that." Yeah. So what they did is they sent me a list of, I think it was like 30 pages, just with a list of queries and say, "Could we know more about that? Or could we change that?" And so I just methodically went through them and it built it out a bit. But essentially, it's very similar.
Obviously, you've investigated and researched as well as spoken about many crimes, solved and unsolved. But out of that, what would you say was the impetus for writing The Unbelieved?
Oh, look, I think for me the biggest impetus was that in my 30 years of writing crime, that crimes against women and children were not under-investigated, because I think the police do a really good job, but they can only work within the parameters that they have. And I've seen those parameters stretch out. But this sort of culture that, when I started it in 2017, we had Me Too, we had Trump, we had Weinstein, we had Grace and Britney, and we just had this thing happening where, I don't know, when I came to adulthood sort of in the late 80s and was getting married and having a child, that you had this thing where women had achieved, you know, "We've achieved equality and equal pay and I can go to work and I can have it all." And then as you get a bit older, you think, yeah, you can have it all, women, but you have to do it all, and you'll do the lion's share of the housework and the childcare, and, you know, you'll have to be the parent and the caregiver at home, as if you don't work. Then you get to a particular age, you know, I hit my 50s, and you start to look around and see women around you being overlooked for promotion at this natural line of promotion. I worked in education, so you see this natural anointing of men appointing men who look like them and sound like them and have similar backgrounds, and you see women being overlooked, and you just kind of think there's something going on here that we need to, you know, that needs to be addressed. And I think that's part of the reason why The Unbelieved resonates with so many women, is that you have that boss that you butt heads against, and that you know that if you stand up for yourself, it is a career-limiting move, and you do it anyway because you can't not do it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you see your career in tatters, or you see a consequence of malice or nastiness or whatever. And I think every woman goes, And so this whole, you're expected to, you know, put up and shut up and work really hard but not really get the recognition that you deserve. And I think that was a really big part of it. So I think the unbelief combines those two really neatly together, in that you have the issues of crimes against women and children not getting the legal strength that they should have. And then you also have women just getting really sick of this kind of treatment in the way that, you know, men, like I was clearing out my spam folder yesterday, and there were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages from, you know, spam guys. Hello, dear. Do you want to marry me? Hello, you're beautiful. Just thought I'd get in touch. Like, leave me alone. And I think the unbelieved really addresses some of that frustration that women have in their everyday lives.
Yeah. I think you said it before, and I want to touch on this a little bit later, but let's call it male entitlement. Yeah, it's definitely a huge theme in this book, and I want to, yeah, I want to talk about that. But first, for those listeners who haven't picked up The Unbelieved yet, can you tell me a little bit more about the story?
Yeah, so it's my character, my protagonist, Antigone Pollard, is a detective, and she has something go catastrophically wrong in Melbourne. And she takes flight, thinking that if she goes to this little coastal town that I invented called Deception Bay, it's not the one in Queensland, it's kind of on the Victorian coast. And she feels like if she goes back there to a place that she spent a lot of time as a child and stays at her nan's old homestead, which is vacant because her nan's just gone into aged care, and she thinks that she just needs a break. And so she's a detective in Deception Bay, and all of a sudden there are shadows of what happened in Melbourne that almost follow her. And I think in all good literature, as in life, if we don't deal with something, it doesn't leave us alone. And so for Antigone, she finds herself in the centre of this kind of drink spiking and targeting of women around the town that really isn't taken seriously, and the women aren't believed. And I think that the point that I really wanted to make with this, and this is true in true crime as well, that when we don't believe women, it escalates. The behaviour does not go away. So when we don't believe one woman, then others will be targeted. And this is, you know, a really strong message. We need to believe women.
As I said, a riveting book. And from the get-go, I knew I was in the hands of an experienced storyteller with this book. Antigone is a marvellous character, a no-holds-barred, unapologetically exceptional detective who will stop at nothing to get justice for victims of crime. So I wanted to ask you, was she inspired by someone in particular, or an amalgamation of inspiring women working both in and outside the justice system?
Yeah, definitely a bit of both. She sort of grew legs when I was writing my book called Once a Copper about Brian the Skull Murphy. And he was one of Australia's toughest cops, and he's now in, you know, he's nearly 90. But he talked about being fearless, and he said, I never suffered from fear. I could just move through my world without feeling fear. And he did battle with, you know, the great bookie robbers and all sorts of terrible characters in those days, the painters and dockers. And the seed of it was born when he said that, because I thought, what if you created a female character who was fearless, who just got on with it? But I also wanted a character that was a little bit different to what you often get in fiction, where you have a character that's got a lot of pulls on her time. And so that she might be pregnant or miscarrying or having an affair, or she's got kids to pick up, or she's got elderly parents. And what we do is we just hammer our female protagonists and make life just so hard for her to wade through. And I made the decision for me and my character, I wanted her to have no pull on her time, so that she could choose to sit down and have a contemplative cup of tea if she wanted to. And no one's going, Mom, what's for dinner? I thought, you know, Jack Reacher doesn't have a pull on his time. Hercule Poirot doesn't have calls on his time. He can just get on with stuff. And I really wanted to create a strong female character. I wanted her to have a really supportive partner as a detective partner, because in the job, women will often have to their side, they'll have men, particularly the younger generation of men, are so incredibly aware and incredibly articulate about equality. And they will often, if the power imbalance is from above, the man at the side will be going, are you okay? Is there anything I can do? I should have spoken up for you. And the woman's going, no, I got this. Thank you, but I got this. And so I wanted to show how that dynamic worked. I didn't want to create, I think in our lives, most of the men that we all know, your dad and the brothers and the husband and the, you know, son-in-laws and the grandchildren, you know, they're beautiful men. But these men do exist. And I think the fact that they do exist means we need to talk about them. But I wanted her to have this, you know, that there's an array of really good blokes that are in the community as well. And so I wanted that balance. It's not all, you know, blokes are evil, because that's not true in life either. So, yeah, an amalgamation, but also this notion of fearlessness. I wanted to have her in boots and all.
Yeah, well, she most certainly was that. As I said earlier, this book was empowering, and because what you've managed to do is to examine the narrative around sexual assault from both sides, how police and the legal system look at these cases, as well as the community and the media. And it begs us to consider how we talk about these cases, how we treat victims of sexual assault, how we talk about them, how the system treats them, etc. So, Vicky, can you share why this was something you wanted to explore in this novel?
I wanted to explore it because often the language of inequality occurs without us noticing. And it occurs in subtle things, like we didn't really notice headlines. Oh, I did as a true crime writer, but when Jane Gilmore starts doing Fixed It, then we all of a sudden start to go, oh my God, that headline is shocking. And these things that happen where these subtleties, like I found these headlines once in a newspaper and showed them to a group of kids, and they argued, a group of year 10 students in an ethics class, and they argued that they were okay. So the headlines were, one of them was, good bloke says friend of murder-suicide dad. So the dad, the story was the dad had shot his children, his little children, and then driven the car, you know, off a ledge and he died. Good bloke says, you know, of murder-suicide dad. And in the same paper, there were two headlines that I found appalling. And one was, you know, love triangle to blame for restaurant stabbing. And that story was a woman had divorced her husband for violence. She had an intervention order after many, many months of being single and recovering from his abuse. She goes online and has her first date, which is in a crowded lunchtime restaurant with a man that she's never met before. And the stalky husband is caught on camera wearing a backpack, approaching this couple at lunch, and he stabs the man to death and stabs the woman. Thankfully, she didn't die, but very severely. And the headline is love triangle to blame. Mm. No, it's not. It's a violent stalker entitled man that says, if I can't have you, no one will. That's who's to blame. It's not a love triangle.
Yeah.
And then the second headline in the same newspaper, in bold, mother drops baby. And then the subheadline was, when stabbed by armed intruder. And the message certainly was, girls, if you're going to get stabbed, don't drop the baby, because that's going to make the headline. Mm. And I thought, what are we doing to women? And I showed the kids, and there's a lot of kids that said, that's all right, it's just clickbait, just want you to click on it. They didn't see any problem with that, and that frightens me. Because, you know, we might be blind to equality, inequality for a while, but all of this leads to a much bigger picture where women are blamed for everything. We're blamed for our own stabbings. We're blamed for dropping a baby if an armed intruder stabs us. We're blamed for the whole lot. And the flip side is men aren't. Men are either good blokes or they're left out of these headings completely. And that's what Jane Gilmore, I think, was trying to do. So that, to me, was a really, really important subtlety that needed to be addressed. Once you shine a spotlight on it, people can never not see it.
I want to talk about the concept of a good bloke, and because this has come up quite frequently in recent episodes of this podcast as a result of books that peel back the facade of what it means to be a good bloke. And this book is no different. And I think at one point a man gives a kid a lift up north and is said to be a good bloke and therefore couldn't possibly be capable of committing a heinous crime. How insidious is this notion? And do we need to reassess what we value as good behaviour, or do we need to just be better at calling out bad behaviour?
I think it all harks back to us not believing the women, doesn't it? So that particularly we see this in celebrity. So when a celebrity is accused of doing something heinous, we have this instant backlash, and we have this instant backlash of people who know the celebrity and they say, but he's a good bloke. I've never seen him behave like that. No, that's because he didn't sexually assault you. So we get this support from men and women that is so strident that it automatically puts the victim down. And we see this in the Amber Heard trial with Johnny Depp. We see it with Meghan Markle. An interesting phenomenon that I've noticed is that we call women liars, because when we call women liars publicly, this is the worst thing that a woman could be, right? You can be serial killers can be serial killers, but if you're a liar, then you're filth and you're to never, ever to be believed. So we saw it in the Brittany Higgins trial. She lied about when she washed a dress. What? You know, we saw Hillary's a liar, Meghan's a liar, Amber's a liar. And so we have this narrative that every time you see that publicly, dig beneath the surface and go, what? What's going on here? And this kind of, we can brush women off. I was on a TV show talking about a true crime case, and the characters in this story, the male had lied and misrepresented the truth, and the woman was said to have done one minor thing. And one of the detectives on the show said, oh, well, clearly she's a liar, isn't she? And the host said, but surely the husband has misrepresented. Oh, no, that's just white noise. I mean, what? This is on national television that you have a man can lie, but it's just white noise, or it's just a man just, you know, making himself sound a bit better than what he is, but a woman, she's a liar. And I just thought, oh, my God, this is what we're up against. So, yeah, the good bloke narrative I think was really important, because we want to keep showing that not everyone does that. There's a lot of decent people out there.
From the get-go, as readers, we're alerted to the age-old narrative around harassment when Antigone is approached by a drunken man in a bar. He asks her to dance, and when she refuses, he abuses her, as if it's his right to expect her to say yes and that she's a bitch for not accepting his proposal. Moral entitlement is a large part of this story too, isn't it?
Yeah. And I noticed I just read a book that had a scene in it, Chris Hammer's latest one, The Tilt, and there's just this one really subtle scene that he does brilliantly, where a girl is riding her bike along a country road, a car sort of pulls up in front of her. This is in the 70s, and I think this would have been more prevalent, but it's by no means non-existent now. And they're like, oh, baby, do you want to hop in the car? The kid's like 13 or 14. And she's like, no, I don't. I'm riding my bike. And then all of a sudden, on the turn of a dime, oh, you bitch, you know, you slut. And just this, if you don't comply and if you don't automatically fall into my wishes, you're then the bitch, the slut. And this, and I just thought, oh, my God, Chris, you nailed that. You know, you really nailed that. That just in that really simple scene, you showed what it can be like. That the minute a woman doesn't comply, the true colours come out. And so I think a lot of writers are exploring this at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Antigone is tough, uncompromising, yet vulnerable in many ways. She's moved to the country to heal from her association with a tragic case beforehand. And part of her healing is wrapped up in Waffles, an ex-police dog. And you've previously written a book about police dogs and their handlers. And this relationship between Antigone and Waffles is a truly special one. Did you specifically want to explore this, and why?
Oh, definitely. When I think my whole 30 years of crime writing seeped in, and my whole 30 years as a professional woman working in the world seeped into this book. And when I was asked to write a book on the dog squad with Penguin a couple of years ago, and they said, you know, you've got to go out to the dog squad and hang out with handlers. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's my dream job. And so I just saw the most amazing dogs. But what I really loved about the stories is that any dog, any highly trained dog, can be a highly trained dog who does stuff on command. But the real joy of these stories was the kind of the naughtiness. Sometimes they can be like naughty little kids. Or one of the handlers said to me, every time the dog misbehaves, the dog is always right. So he had a story about they were out searching for an old woman who'd wandered off in the country from aged care, and he let the dog off the lead, and the dog goes and searches in a paddock, and then he, you know, the dog just sits down at the edge of this paddock and he's calling the dog and the dog won't come, and the handler's saying, bloody dog, and he's walking across the paddock to retrieve the dog. And as he gets closer, behind the dog he can see these little old lady legs sticking out. And he realised that the dog had found the woman, and normally he would do an alert bark, but it was like the dog knew that if he barked, he would frighten her. And so all of these stories that just give you shivers, they're so beautiful and so intuitive. And quite a few of the handlers talked about the dog after a really traumatic event, kind of leaning against their leg a bit, which they're not technically supposed to do, but that, I'm here, boss. You know, we got this. You're okay. And so I really wanted to capture those moments where the dogs did that, but also the excitement that when the dog is being particularly ferocious, its tail's wagging because it's having fun. And this is play to the dog. So that notion of Waffles being that alpha male and taking down bad guys, and she doesn't even have to ask. You know, you can command a dog to attack, but you don't even have to ask. If the dog senses the handler is under threat, the dog will bite. And so as many TV camera people and boom operators have found out, if they go and film at the dog squad, they'll get too close with the boom, the dog will just bite them, and the handler's like, yay, you know, you've been baptized. You know, so there's this kind of relationship that I just loved. And as a dog owner myself, I thought, I want to give her someone, a dog that's really, really powerful. I have really tiny, I just lost one of them, but my other one, you know, she's like 5 kilos and she's tiny and fluffy. She's not going to do that to anyone. But I really like the idea of that kind of alpha companion, that if she's ever in jeopardy and she can't handle it, that the dog is going to step in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you nailed that. And that relationship was just so beautiful. And it was comforting in a way to know that she had Waffles to lean on when she needed him. Yeah.
And Waffles, and I love this scene where, you know, I have Antigone's ex-boyfriend arrive on the scene. And so not only does the dog protect her from predatory behavior and violent behavior, but the dog also protects her emotionally and does a bit of the leg leaning and a bit of the creating that barrier and just going, no, don't go near her. She doesn't want you to. That relationship that I think a lot of women, a lot of people have, it's not even a woman thing, a lot of people have with their dogs, don't they?
Yeah. Antigone kind of leaps from the frying pan into the fire when she moves to Deception Bay. The spate of unsolved sexual assault cases or ones not pursued have got the townswomen scared, and it's evident that there's something rotting in the town. In your investigations and research, how common is it to find towns like Deception Bay, towns that kind of close ranks?
Look, I think I've done a few events with Marg Hickey, who wrote Stonetown and Cutter's End, and amazing books. And she actually lives in a small town. And she described it perfectly when she said that small towns are just a microcosm of big towns. You know, like you've got your bossy people and your interfering people and your creepy people, and they're the same in cities, but they're just maybe a little bit more condensed in a small town. You don't get any difference in crimes. You've still got drug problems and unemployment. And so I think that placing all of these things in a small town kind of puts a frame around it and that it compacts it. But I think any thing that resonates is a universal thing. And in one of the books that I wrote many years ago on institutionalized abuse, on one man's experience of that, I found myself saying a lot in the telling the story of one, you tell the story of many. And so many people got in touch and said, wow, now that I've read his story, I understand my dad or my uncle who was in that same boys' home. And I think what I hope I did in The Unbelieved is that when you tell the story of one woman who suffers from family violence, or a woman having to keep a secret or having to hide what's truly going on, when you tell that one story, you tell a bigger story to a lot of people. And this is where this resonance comes from. And going back to what we're talking about with reviews, you can have a book that resonates for that very reason, and you can have a book that just doesn't. If a woman says, I don't identify with those experiences at all, fine. But there's so many people that will be going, oh my God, this speaks to my heart.
I want to talk just briefly about women in policing. Antigone is seriously affected by her previous experience, as we mentioned before, and perhaps this colours her Deception Bay investigations, but she almost immediately isn't believed. So it's not just the victims of the sexual assault cases in this book that aren't believed, but she herself isn't believed when she reports being assaulted by a perpetrator. Do you think that there is an inherent prejudice against women in the police service?
Look, I think that is really, really changing. When I first started to write stories, I think there was a lot of, you know, men of a certain era, but 30 years down the track, those men have either retired or they've moved on. And what I really loved, probably maybe a decade ago, I would hear female friends in the police force start to talk about that kind of behaviour, and they'd say, oh, yeah, he's a dinosaur. And I thought, this is great, because these women are recognising that those attitudes coming out of the mouths of men are dinosaurs and will soon be extinct. And I think now the police force are really good at calling it out. And, I mean, there's always room for improvement. The police force, again, are a microcosm of society. But now we have a language for it. I think women back in the day would have just been putting up with that kind of appalling behaviour, as women did everywhere. A teacher friend of mine, she would go to work every day, and I think this would have been in the 70s, and that a guy would grope her breasts every morning and go, oh, hello to these puppies, or something. Sexual assault every morning. And when she reported it to the principal, she was called in, and she walks in, and the guy that's sexually assaulting her is sitting there, and the principal telling her, oh, don't be such a bad sport about this. So I think, I mean, it's unbelievable that that would have happened in education at a school, no doubt. And I think, you know, the police force would be no different, but I think like all professions, you leave yourself wide open to legal action if you don't create a safe work environment for your women.
Yeah, absolutely, as we see what's happening with Brittany Higgins.
But until you call it out, the whole parliament swamp, it sounds like, until she stepped forward and said, hey, this happened, and everybody just believed her, and then it the whole thing had to change. The lid was lifted off it. When we don't believe women, it's the path of least resistance. Nothing has to change. Yeah. If we go, oh, Brittany's a liar, then nothing changes. But if we say, I believe her, then everything has to change. Yeah. And that's a big, big lot of change.
Indeed it is. Vicky, if there was one thing that you would like listeners and readers to take away from your book, what would it be?
I think that the book, even though it is, it deals with some really tough topics, I think the book has a lot of heart, and I think that it is a gentle leading through these things that when you read it, you will come out hopefully saying, whoa, I didn't know that. That's, wow, I need to know that. And a lot of the reviews that say this changes the way that I think about the world, they're, you know, I mean, as a teacher and as a writer, they're the reviews that I go, oh, wow, that's amazing. So I just think that even though it is a disturbing topic, I think it is a gently covered. It's not an in-your-face. Even my own daughter, she didn't read it. And, I said to her, have you read my book? Because I don't care if you don't read my true crime, but it's going to look a bit awkward if the mums at the school that your kids go to are saying, oh, I've read your mum's book, and you go, I haven't read it. And she goes, Mum, I'm scared that you're going to hurt the people. And I went, read it. It does, you'll be okay. And so I had to even convince my own daughter that everyone that needed to come through fine will come through fine. Yeah. And you don't have to worry that I'm going to kill off all the good characters. She did not trust me. I think that's terrible, isn't it? Your own daughter. I should check on her progress. She is reading it, but I think she's kind of reading it like, oh, my God, is everyone going to be okay? So she's it's quite funny.
Vicky, I feel like we haven't heard the last of Antigone Pollard. So I'm wondering if you're planning to bring her back for another book.
Yeah, look, I started the sequel last year and I knew that I won the prize. They didn't announce it till April, but I knew back in September and I wasn't allowed to say anything, which was really hard secret to keep. But I got an idea for the sequel maybe in about September and started writing, and that really took off, and so all the establishment bits are done, and then the true crime sort of took over. So the book's on its way, but at the moment I'm doing a podcast to try and keep the Frankston serial killer in prison, and that always will take precedence because this is vital and important work to keep women safe for real. These two sort of parallel careers, and Denya just applied for parole last week, so we're all reeling from that. So there's a sense of urgency to get this done. So I feel like that might get in the way a little bit of the writing process, but, I'm doing my darndest. But, yeah, they're on the way. And then a lot of the reviews said we want to hear more of Waffles and Wazza and Antigone, and I went, oh, that's great. But, they're on their way, but not quickly.
Fantastic. Vicky, I might have mentioned earlier that there are a lot of writers who listen to this podcast, and given your journey to publication, certainly in terms of fiction, I wondered if you had any tips to offer writers out there.
My biggest tip is when you're a writer, you have to, my advice is to write your heart. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the comments that you read are, I'm not good enough, there's all of this kind of self-doubt. But the truth is that only I can write the unbelieved, because every inch of my existence and life experience is poured into this book, and that's why it resonates. And so every single writer brings a unique and beautiful load of self-experience to the work. So don't ever think that someone can do it better than you, because nobody can do it like you. But I think have a little faith in yourself. This self-doubt that I see a lot in, or maybe it's just self-deprecation, I don't know, but it feels like doubt, and people, I've sent it off and I haven't got any answers and whatever. I just like keep writing, and don't try and be thinking, when 50 Shades of Grey came out and everyone's like, oh, let's quick write some bondage. But it's like you can't, because the author of 50 Shades of Grey, again, brought her special mix to that, and you can't do the thing that she does. So just always believe in yourself, because I am a prime example of, again and again in my career, when I wrote The Frankston Serial Killer, I sent it to all of the major publishers and they all rejected it. No, we don't do that kind of thing. No one wants to read that kind of thing. I ended up having to self-publish that, and it became a bestseller within probably about the first 5 weeks. And so publishers were wrong. And just because it hasn't been done, just because they're risk-averse, doesn't mean that your story isn't really, really worthy. So basically the core of my advice is just believe in yourself and trust yourself.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that. If listeners out there wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
I think my Facebook author page is the main kind of thing. I have a website that I haven't updated with the prize, which I need to get onto, but I don't know how to do it, so that's why I keep putting it off. But if you follow my Facebook page or Twitter, any events that I'm doing, talks, I always post them. So, and there's a message through my website. People often send me messages.
Vicky, I wanted to say how much I enjoyed The Unbelieved, an incredible debut. I cannot wait to see what comes next. Thank you so much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading.